Maybe they can get here. Thank you.
Okay, so the questions, I'll take them as many as possible here. How do we assume that we are progressing in spiritual life? I think it's not assuming, how do we infer that we are progressing in spiritual life? In the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, it is said, Bhakti Pareshanubhava Virakti Ranyatracha. Bhakti is a process that gives Para Isha Anubhava. Isha is controller or God. Para is one who is transcendental. Anubhava is experience. So Bhakti gives us experience of Krishna. And the result of that experience of Krishna is Viraktir Anyatracha. Virakti is detachment. Detachment from other things. That means, when we experience Krishna, that experience is so fulfilling that we stop craving for other experiences. So Srila Prabhupada, when he was asked, how do we know we are advancing? Prabhupada gave the example, which comes in the second part of this verse. When we eat food, how do we know that we are being nourished? So that two things, we feel strong and we don't feel the hunger for more food. So similarly, when Krishna enters into our consciousness and Krishna nourishes our consciousness, then we feel spiritually strong. Spiritually strong means that we feel determined, inspired to serve Krishna more and more. Spiritual strength is in terms of our determination to serve Krishna. And secondly, just as when we are satisfied, when we are getting good food, then we don't crave, our hunger gets relieved. So like that, similarly when we experience Krishna, that experience is so satisfying that we don't crave for worldly experiences, for sensual experiences, for mundane pleasures. So in that sense, there's an internal symptom of spiritual advancement is that we experience Krishna. We experience fulfillment in the experience of Krishna. And the external symptom is that how do we know that somebody is actually experiencing Krishna? They are detached from other experiences. They no longer crave for other experiences. So if we see these two things, that we are getting more and more satisfaction in Krishna and we are not craving for other experiences, then we can understand that we are advancing. And in this also, we need not focus too much on desires, because desires will keep coming and going. Even when we become advanced devotees, still we might see some sense object and some desire may come temporarily. Spiritual advancement should be seen not so much in terms of change of desires as in terms of change of values. Change of desire means that we never get any bad desire. But the nature of this world is that we will see certain things, certain memories may come up and some wrong desires may come up. But what is our response to those desires? The famous verse that Srila Yamunacharya of Yamunacharya Srila Prabhupada would quote, he said that Yadavadhi mama cheta krishna padaravinde. Whenever I think of sense gratification, my lips curl in distaste and I spit at the thought. Now Prabhupada would focus on his response and how he would respond. But again the point is that even for a great saint like Yamunacharya, the thought might come in the mind. So desires may come. But how do we respond to those desires? That is change of values. You know, initially, when we are materialistic at that time, worldly desires, when they come in, we roll out the red carpet for them. Now, welcome! But when we advance, when we become serious devotees, what do? We raise the red flag. This is danger. So that change from red carpet to red flag. That is a change of value. And as long as our desires may not change, I mean, wrong desires may come up. But if we are not welcoming those desires, if you are not entertaining those desires, if you are resisting and rejecting those desires, then that itself is a sign of spiritual advancement.
Okay.
If all devotees of Krishna go back to Godhead, then some devotees are more dedicated and do more service. and others are less dedicated and do less service. If all of them are going to go back to Godhead, then what is the need to do more service and be more dedicated?
Yeah.
Krishna consciousness is a process of love. It is not like a business of mutual exploitation where we want to do as less as possible for Krishna and we want to get as much out of Krishna as possible. That is not love. So there is Krishna's love which is expressed in his declarations. You do even little bhakti, I will deliver you. I will take you to me. Lord Ramchandra says that if somebody chants my name only once, I will forever grant him fearlessness. That is his love for us, which is making a declaration. But if I say, I have chanted once now protect me for the rest of eternity. Now that is not our love. So love actually can be one way, but relationships cannot be one way. For a relationship to be there, there has to be reciprocation on the other side also. So Krishna always loves us. And out of his mercy, even if we do little, he will appreciate that. But if we want to love Krishna, then we have to do as much as we can in his service. And actually speaking, the purpose of spiritual life is not just to go to the spiritual world. Because if I go to the spiritual world, and if I think how much money is in my bank balance here, then what is the point of being in the spiritual world? The speciality of the spiritual world is not just in the location. The speciality of the spiritual world is in the disposition. That everybody, it's not just that so you go there, then you'll become happy automatically. No, it is the mentality of the people there that makes them happy. The disposition is that they absorb in Krishna. And that absorption we need to cultivate. So Krishna is so merciful that he will open the doors of the spiritual world for even those who are practicing bhakti a little bit. But this such declarations of Krishna should inspire us. Oh, Krishna is so merciful. Why should I love things anything other than him? Let me offer myself wholeheartedly to him. So as sadhakas, the mood of love is that I want to do as much as possible for Krishna. And if I'm not able to do, then still Krishna is not a fault-finding God. Krishna will still accept. So the scriptural statements have to be always seen in a proper light which inspires us in our service of Krishna. If we use the scriptural statement to justify our lackadaisical performance of bhakti, our half-hearted performance of bhakti, then we miss out on the purpose of scripture. The purpose of scripture is there are multiple levels of instruction by which you can all come towards Krishna. So Krishna will accept everyone. But actually to be accepted by him, in the sense that for us to experience the sweetness of his love, we have to direct our heart towards Krishna. It's like, if our heart is directed towards other things, because we are performing little bhakti, little dedication, when our heart is directed to other things, then we will not experience the ecstasy of Krishna prema. The ecstasy of Krishna prema is experienced only when we are absorbed in Krishna. And that's why we should strive as much as possible to offer as much as we can to Krishna. And then we will be happy even in this world. What to speak of the next?
You just mentioned Lord Ramachandra. And why is it that he didn't consult his guru before sending Sita in the forest?
Okay. Why did Lord Ram not consult Sita before sending her to the forest?
He consulted Vasishtha.
Sorry.
So why did Ram not consult Vasishtha before sending Sita to the forest? Actually, there are multiple things involved over here. Firstly, Lord Ram, he is God himself. And when he descends in this world as an ideal human being, he demonstrates the duties of a human being. But still, he does many times things which a human being cannot do. No human being could have killed Ravana. No human being could have single-handedly destroyed thousands of warriors at the time of the battle in Janasthana. So, Ram is God. And in some situations, he acts in his position as God. And in some situations, he acts as a human being. That is the meaning of Leela. Now, in this particular situation, when he had to banish, when he had to send Sita to the forest, actually there are multiple levels of reason for this. The external reason is that she was accused of being unchaste, and Ram, in order to protect the reputation of the king, he sent her to the forest. That is actually a very external reason. Now, it is not that Ram was more concerned about his reputation than about his wife. Actually, if you see the reason, if Ram had just been interested in one's own pleasure, which might come through reputation also, then actually later on, for a king to perform a royal sacrifice without his wife next to him, that is very improper. All the royal sacrifices that are to be performed, the husband and the wife are to perform them together. And yet Lord Ram did never married again. He never accepted any other wife. So the point was, there was a higher principle involved over here. All of us have multiple roles that we have. So for example, you know, a woman may be having a job, she has a profession, and she's also a mother. She also is a house, she also has a wife. There are many different roles, like that a man may be a father, maybe a husband, maybe a professional. So different roles sometimes conflict. So for Lord Ram at that time, there were two roles which were there. One was his role as a husband who is meant to protect his wife. The second is a king who, now the king has enormous royal opulence. And yet the king is meant to establish the example of dharma and detachment. The king establishes, while ruling, the king expresses detachment not by living in Spartan austerity, but by subordinating oneself to the sages who have nothing. Normally people offer respect to the people who are wealthy. But here a person who is fabulously wealthy is offering respect to someone who has nothing. That's how people developed appreciation for spiritual culture. So the king is expected to express detachment also. So now he had both these duties. So if a king appears attached to his worldly opulence, to his queen and such things, then that will set an example where everyone will become attached. And that is undesirable for their spiritual growth. So Lord Ram reconciled these two different duties which he had by sending Sita to the forest. Now sometimes people say that Ram banished Sita. Banish is not an appropriate word for what Ram did. Because banishment means one is sent right out of the kingdom, deep into the forest with absolutely nothing at all. Ram, when Sita was sent to the forest, it was that forest was Valmiki's ashram. It was not just out in the dark jungles. See, banishment means the way Ram was sent into the forest. So out of Ayodhya, into the deep dark forests. That was not what happened to Sita. So Sita was still in Ram's kingdom only. Valmiki's ashram was in Ram's kingdom only. So Ram was put in. So that means Sita was still indirectly under Ram's protection through being in his kingdom in the hermitage of Valmiki. And from the Gaudiya Vaishnava perspective, we understand that love is intensified through separation. So Ram arranged for Sita to be separated from him so that both of them could experience the intensity, the highest love of love in separation. Now these are all transcendental considerations that he had. And with these transcendental considerations in mind, he acted. So the Lord can sometimes act according to the instructions of the spiritual master, and sometimes he may act by his own will. That is his supremacy. Okay?
Yes, but literally in Valmiki Ramayana, at the beginning of his exile, Vasishtha was among those who came with Bharata Maharaj, who requested him to come back to Ayodhya. So if in the second or the first instance he didn't consult, but in the second or in this instance he basically disregarded his request. That's even kind of,
So Ram also did not seem to obey Vasishtha when Vasishtha came and asked him to come back to the kingdom. So actually the relationship over there is quite different from the way we have relationships in the Vaishnava Sampradaya. Now, Ram's spiritual master was not exactly Vashishta. Now, he was their family priest. And even now, if you see, they are in different traditions, they have different ways. In the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya, usually they don't have Diksha Guru the way we have in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. They have what is called a Grantha Guru. That means for each, if you want to study one book, you go to one guru. If you want to study another book, you go to another guru. Of course, I have one primary spiritual guide, whose guidance we take, whose blessings we take while going to by the various other specialist teachers also. So the point here is, Vashishtha was the family priest. And as the family priest, he was more of a advisor rather than a spiritual master. So in our terms, we may use the word spiritual master. But the mantras, especially the martial mantras, were given to him not by Vashishtha, but by Vishwamitra. And later on also, before the Kurukshetra, before the Lanka Yuddha, it was Agastya Muni also gave another set of mantras. And Ram kill Ravana using the Aditya Hridaya mantra, which was given by Vashishtha. So in that sense, the Brahmana or the priest is the advisor for the king. And the king has his discretion by which the king may sometimes choose to follow the instruction, sometimes choose not to follow the instruction. And Ram was not just acting in defiance of his guru. He said that I have my father's instruction. And there is no immediate exigency because of which I should not follow my father's instruction. So there is, in the Bhagavatam also we see that sometimes Bali Maharaj does not follow the instruction of Shukracharya. So the point is that there is the principle of dharma, and one principle of dharma is we should follow the instruction of our elders. Spiritual master is the foremost elder, and spiritual master instructions are extremely important. But in this case, Vashishtha Muni was not exactly the spiritual master of Ram. He was a royal priest, and Ram had other principles of dharma to consider while choosing his actions. And that's how he acted accordingly. So it is said association of devotees is very important. But what if when we are outside the temple, we have to associate with non-devotees? And what if we are in a situation where we have no option except to associate with non-devotees? Answer: association is not just physical proximity. Association is primarily emotional affinity. It's not physical proximity. Prabhupada would give the example that a fly sits on the lap of the spiritual master. The fly is not associated with the spiritual master. Because there is physical proximity, but the fly, there's no emotional affinity there. The fly simply irritates the spiritual master. So, like that, association is a matter of where the hearts are linked. So we may have to, for functional purposes, for professional purposes, we may have to associate with people. And they may be devotees, they may be non-devotees. That is perfectly okay. It is, even in the past, in Vedic culture, it is not that, even when Vedic culture was there, it is not that everybody was a devotee. Everybody, in the past, people were more dharmic. But it is not, even in the past also, it is not that everyone was devotee. So there is always a situation possible where our values and the values of people around us may not be the same. So in such a situation, we need some devotee association which inspires us to recommit ourselves to our spiritual values. And when we associate with devotees, there essentially there should be a transfer of spiritual desires. We associate with devotees means devotees want to study about Krishna, serve Krishna, chant about Krishna, worship Krishna. And by associating with them, that desire should also come within us. And the desire is coming strongly within us, then we are associating with devotees, wherever we may be. And if we work for functional purposes, and while working with others, one of the advantages of today's postmodern culture is, people don't intrude into other space. You know, you be what you want to be, you let me be what I want to be. That's how people are mostly in the professions of the world also. So if we are doing our job well, if we are doing our work properly, and people let us do what we want to do. They may push us a little bit, but if we make our boundaries clear, people leave it to us. So usually, if we have strong devotee association in terms of we are associating with those who infuse us with spiritual desires, then therein we are getting good association wherever we may be. Nowadays, an advantage of technology is that we can get association even if we are not physically close to a temple. We can hear classes, we can be on through various medias, we can associate with devotees. So we should make sure that we get spiritual desires through some association, some means. And while associating with materialistic people, if we stick primarily to the functional activity that we are doing and we don't get involved in, then we are talking about movies and sense gratification and parties and these things, where these things involve anti-devotional actions, we don't get involved in them. We keep a distance from them. Then that we may be physically associating, but we won't be emotionally degrading by that association. Who is Vishnu and who is Krishna? Sometimes I get confused with these two. Yes. Vishnu and Krishna are the same one Supreme God. They are one person, two personalities. It's one person in two different moods, two different personalities. Roughly speaking, we would say that Krishna is God at home. Vishnu is God in office. Krishna is God at home. And that is why Krishna is very relaxed. Sometimes you may see the Prime Minister in office or the military general in office. You know, he's having a formal uniform, maybe having guns with him, and everybody is bowing down to him. But that same military general may come back home and maybe has a son who makes him a horse and rides on top of him. So like that, the Supreme Lord in the form of Vishnu is, he has Shankha Chakra Gada Padma. He's very formal. And informally he is worshipped. But that same the Supreme Lord at home, he is Krishna. Sometimes he plays with his Gopas and the Gopas defeat him and they say, you have to carry us now. And Krishna carries others. So, it is the same person in two different moods. And both of them are the same one Supreme Lord. Their moods may be different, but they are the same one Supreme Person. And if we become devoted to that Supreme Person, we can become liberated from material existence. So, there are subtle differences between the two, but those subtle differences need not become too important for us. We should focus on the principle that they are one person in different moods. And because Krishna is God at home, so more his more personal, his personal intimate nature is revealed more, and the reciprocation of affection between him and his devotees is more easily evident in his form as Krishna. And that's why we who want to develop affectionate love for Krishna, we focus more on Krishna and the manifestation of God as Krishna. But essentially, they're the same person and we don't have to make a big issue about the difference between the two. It's just different moods. Is it not better to learn or understand one God instead of many names? Yes, there is only one God. The one God and his many names are not contradictory things. Because it's the same one person who has many names. Advaitam Achyutam Anadim Anantarupam. Advaitam. He's one person, but he has Anantarupam. He has many, many forms. And corresponding with his forms, corresponding with his qualities, corresponding with his activities, he has different names. So we don't have to think that they are two different persons. So if the different names of the Lord confuse us, then we should focus not just on the name, but understand the meaning of the name. And understand who is being referred to by that name. The same object may be called as water in English. It may be called as jala in Hindi. It may be called as apo in Sanskrit. But it's the same object. So like the same God may be known by different names. And we need to see that the names are referred to the same person. And that way we can avoid confusion. Do we need to have a Shiksha Guru, Diksha Guru, or is Shiksha Guru sufficient? Yes, both of them are required. The soul's journey towards Krishna is facilitated, is guided by many different guides. The first guide is the one who shows the way, the Pathapadarshak Guru. Shiksha Guru is one who gives instructions. And there can be many Shiksha Gurus. Diksha Guru is a person who formalizes our connection with Krishna and takes the primary responsibility for guiding us towards Krishna. So, we should not separate the two as entirely different. Nor should we think that one makes the other redundant. They all play their different roles. So, if you consider Sampradaya to be like a university, Samyak Rupena Pradayate Iti Sampradaya, that which gives a systematic spiritual knowledge is called a Sampradaya. Now, in a Sampradaya, there is, in a university, when a student is admitted, at that time, there is a formal authority, maybe the dean or the principal or the chief administrative officer, whoever it may be. It is their sanction which ensures the student gets formally admitted. And without that, the student is not formally in the university. But after the student is admitted, the student may have, if they say they are doing PhD, they may have different PhD, they may have one PhD guide for one field, another PhD, another guide for another field. So they may have different guides over there. So specifically, the learning may happen from different professors. But all those professors are part of the same university. And within that university, the formal admission happens through one particular authority. So the formal authorization of our connection with the Sampradaya happens through the spiritual master, through the Diksha Guru. And that's why the Diksha Guru is important. But from the practical instruction point of view, the education that we get and the elevation that we have, that may happen through many other sources also. So that's why Chaitanya Charitamrita says that the Shiksha Guru and the Diksha Guru are non-different. Non-different in what sense? That they are all fulfilling the same one purpose. That is of elevating us by giving us knowledge of Krishna. So in that sense, we need all of them. We need to be formally admitted in this university, and we also need to be systematically instructed in the university. And all of them are play their own roles. So both of Shiksha and Diksha Guru, all are essential.
When we talk about Guru Tattva, who was the Shiksha and Diksha Guru of Jata Bharat?
So can we, we had this system here. Don't mind. We would like to take this question, sir. Sometimes we make wrong choices, may act wrongly because of our proclivities, and we don't even realize it. So if we don't even realize what we are doing wrong, then how can we do right, the right action as devotees? Yes, this is what happens, especially when we are in the lower modes. One humorous way of explaining the three modes is, some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, and some people wonder what happened. So, in goodness, people are purposeful. They observe, they understand, and they make things happen. Brahmanas don't just run around doing things, they make things happen. Some people watch things happen. When you are too much in passion, at that time, I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to do that. But often we do things thoughtless, not very thoughtfully. And that's why one thing leads to a chain reaction. This happened, and everything becomes very complicated. And we just get to watch things. Oh, this is happening. We watch things happen. And in the ignorance, some people wonder what happened. This whole thing is just, we just don't figure out what is happening. Shigaunitai Bhagavan ki. So, the process of spiritual advancement, it also means that we become more self-aware. Self-aware means that we become more aware of what we are doing, what we are thinking, how we are desiring, how we are acting. And this self-awareness happens as we rise more and more towards Sattva-guna. See, self-awareness is not self-consciousness. Self-consciousness means that, say, if I'm sitting right now, I'm thinking, how do I look? Is my tilak proper? what are people thinking about me? We are just basically conscious of our externals. That sort of thing is unfavorable. Self-aware means we are more reflexively, internally aware. Okay, what am I doing? Not in the sense of how the world is perceiving me, but in terms of my own values, how am I acting? That happens when we come towards the mode of goodness more and more. And there's an interesting psychiatric study that was done. Nowadays, a lot of people have a problem of overeating and obesity because of that. So people were asked, in a day, how many food-related choices do you make? You know, should I eat this, should I not eat this? Should I eat this much or should I eat this much? So like that. So they did a survey, and on average, for several hundred people, they did a survey. They said that we actually did 12 choices. 12, 14 choices, that's what they said. But when they went back over the day, they found that they had made 227 choices. So more than 200 choices, they did not notice only. It was just like, so one of the things that happens is, distraction is an invitation for temptation. That means if I'm distracted, if I'm doing one thing and I'm thinking of something else, then while thinking, okay, I'm talking on phone, I'm also looking at my computer, and without my realizing, my hand goes into a sweet box and I eat a sweet. So what happens? If we are too distracted, then we are not aware of what we are doing. So sometimes we feel I'm chanting and I'm not able to concentrate on chanting. What is the use of my chanting? But to become conscious that we are not concentrating is also a form of concentration. I may be distracted and I may not even realize that I am distracted. If I am distracted and I realize that I am distracted, that also indicates that there is some level of awareness. So even if we are chanting and we are not able to concentrate, still if we try to concentrate, that at least becoming aware that I am distracted and becoming concentrated, trying to concentrate again. Again getting distracted, again coming back to concentration. This at least makes us aware of where our consciousness is. And this helps us in the rest of our life. So when we are doing other actions, when we start doing something wrong, just by the attempt to concentrate during our chanting, we have become more and more aware, and that self-awareness carries over to other activities. So in general, by developing sattva guna, and by practicing Krishna consciousness, by which we become more and more aware of where our consciousness is, we can recognize when our proclivities are moving us towards wrong things. And we can correct ourselves. And specifically, if we have some particular conditionings which push us towards wrong things, then there are two things which we can do to deal with it. First is, create some obstacle between ourselves and that particular indulgence. So don't keep that indulgence readily available. Now in Google, also they had Google as a company, they had this experiment which was done that they had their shop, the cafeteria sort of thing, where there were sweet chocolates and all such delicacies which were kept in transparent bottles. And as a part of the experiment, they just changed it and they put it in covers which were non-transparent. And just by doing that, the consumption of sweets, of desserts, of chocolates among the employees decreased by 35%. So, out of sight to some extent means out of mind. So that way, if you don't keep the temptation readily available, even if the proclivity comes, come on, do this. But it's not readily available, then we have to go through some trouble to get to that. And in that process, our intelligence comes back to us. Hey, I should not be doing this. So sometimes people have a problem that they may, nowadays with internet available everywhere, people can surf wrong sites, undesirable sites. And just one click and suddenly the whole world of garbage can open up to us. So then, if that is a problem, then we have some internet filter or something which restricts the sites that we go to. So basically, whatever is our weakness, we can try to create obstacles between us and that indulgence. So that in the instinct comes, we don't act immediately on it. And secondly, when this sort of thing happens, we can ourselves observe what are our triggers. What are our triggers means? Our consciousness has broadly three zones. There is a safe zone, there is a danger zone, and there is a fall zone, a relapse zone. Safe zone means at that time we are not very agitated. It's overall peaceful. Danger zone means the temptation is not troubling us. And then relapse zone means where we fall into the condition. So it is our triggers that take us from the safe zone to the danger zone to the relapse zone. And all of us have different triggers. So we can become more aware of what the triggers of our consciousness are. And then once we become aware of the triggers of our consciousness, then we can take safety measures. Just like in a house, there is a fire occurring, if there is a fire alarm, and the fire alarm occurs, then at that time, we come to know that the fire has come before the fire becomes very big. So like that, as we practice bhakti, it is not that the fire of desire will not erupt in the heart. But when the fire of desire erupts, we become aware faster. Yeah, this is happening, let me check myself. So that requires practice. Even if the important thing is not that what we do when the proclivity comes and pushes us. Sometimes sometimes electricity is there going like this. If this is normal electric level, sometimes the electricity spikes come up. And when the spikes come up, at that time the desire becomes very strong. And we may not be able to resist also at that time. But the important thing is what we do between the spikes. That means sometimes we say, oh, I've fallen down now, so let me fall down completely. No, you've fallen down, okay, rise now. There's no need to fall down further just because I have fallen down. The mind often plays a very dangerous double role. What is a double role? First, the mind makes us do wrong things. Do this, you will enjoy. Do this, you will enjoy. Do this, you will enjoy. And then, after we do it, and we say, this is so little pleasure. Why did I do that? Now, what happened? The same mind, which made us a criminal, now goes and sits on the seat of a judge and judges us. Why did you do that? You're such a fool. And it beats us up. And now this beating, it actually doesn't help us improve. It only makes us more discouraged. So, either way, in both cases, we are mind conscious. We are not Krishna conscious. And mind consciousness means we will stay trapped in the clutches of the mind. So, okay, if the spike of desire came up and I fell down, I did something wrong, okay, that's over now. If the spike has come now, now it is gone. Now, let me not think about that. Let me think about Krishna. Let me, by practicing bhakti intensely, purify myself, strengthen myself. So, if when the spike happens, it may not be in our control, but what happens between the spikes, that is very much in our control. And if at that time we are intensifying our bhakti, if at that time we are purifying ourselves, we are nourishing ourselves spiritually, then gradually when the spikes come also, we will be able to resist. So, rather than worrying about what will happen when the next time temptation comes, whether I will resist it or not, whether I will be able to protect myself or not, whether I will fall on, focus on what we are doing right now. Right now we nourish ourselves, gradually we will come to a level where we will be able to resist temptation later. Why did Shalya fight on the side of the Kauravas? Just because Duryodhana served him when he was on the way to go to the Pandavas. So, Shalya was the uncle of Nakula and Sahadev, and he was, relatively speaking, a virtuous king. He wanted to fight on the side of the Pandavas. But at that time, while he was going along, Duryodhana arranged a very high quality service camp where he could stay and he would facilitate. So he was so pleased. He just assumed that Yudhishthira had arranged this. And he said, the person who has arranged such excellent facilities for me, I will surely give up my life for his sake. And immediately Duryodhana appeared over there and said, I arranged all this. Shalya was flummoxed. He didn't know what to do at that time. So, actually, it was, you could say, a mistake of judgment. See, the two mistakes, one of the principles which is said in the Niti Shastra is, when you are very happy, don't make a promise to anyone. Because in the elation of happiness, emotions often, they push our intelligence down. And that's why we may speak things which are excessive. So, that was one mistake on his part. And second thing is, yes, it was a further mistake was that in such a situation, even if he has given a word, Yes, a Kshatriya, for Kshatriyas, their word of honor is very important. Because Kshatriyas have a lot of power. They are the kings. And if they simply start acting according to their whims or according to whatever is convenient for them, then they can become very exploitative and abusive. And that's why it is ingrained in the Kshatriyas that your word of honor has to be extremely important. If you promise something, you must do it. And by that word of honor, by that consistent emphasis on their word of honor, the Kshatriyas are inspired to act honorably. And that's how they don't succumb to the impulse for power and impulse for exploitation or domination because of the word of honor. And because of being brought up in a culture where one should honor one's word. But sometimes any principle can be taken to its excess. So word of honor is very important. But if in order to preserve one's word of honor, one has to live a life of dishonor, then that is excess of a principle. So in the Bhakti Samas, in Upadeshamrut, it talks about Niyamagraha, sticking to the letter of the law while forgetting the purpose of the law. So Shalya committed that error in terms of sticking to his word and ending up fighting on the side of Adharma. But of course, it was, we can also see it from the point of view of Duryodhana's cunningness, by which he trapped Shalya using his strength. Shalya was a very honorable person, and quite often Maya can be so subtle that the very thing that we can use in the service of Krishna, Maya can allure us through that very thing. I may be a very good singer, and I can sing very nicely, and I can absorb myself in Krishna, I can absorb others in Krishna. But through that very singing, if I become proud, I think I sing so nicely. So what may happen is, by my singing, others are remembering Krishna, but I am not remembering Krishna. So we have to be careful. So the word of honor is important, but the word of honor also has to be used ultimately for the purpose of dharma. So please explain about Krishna's disappearance. How is it that when he departed from this world, he left a material body? How was that? Actually, the Bhagavatam talks about this elaborately in the 11th canto, and Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur also explains this further. He says, firstly, I'll summarize his various arguments. First of all, if we want to go according to material logic, Krishna left a body, therefore he is also like ordinary human being, with a body and a soul. But then we can see further, what was the context? It was a hunter who came and hit Krishna on the leg. Now, a wound on the leg is practically never fatal. A wound on the leg, an arrow hitting the leg, it may kill if that arrow is, say, rusted and there is infection that spreads all over the body. After that, after quite some complication, a person will die. Normally, an arrow to the leg never kills anyone. And Krishna was not like some sickly, weak person. A small wound killed him. He was a great warrior, even if you want to look from the material perspective. So, the idea of an arrow on the leg killing someone itself is illogical, if you want to stick purely to logic. Further, now if Krishna's death was like a materialistic person's death, then when that hunter shot the arrow at Krishna, and supposedly that caused a fatal wound, Krishna was not at all angry with that hunter. And the hunter was actually regretful. I thought this was an animal and it was you, oh Lord, please forgive me. And Krishna told him, this is all my plan. Krishna was not at all angry. Normally, you know, even in an honorable war, if one warrior kills another warrior, that warrior feels anger, feels pain, feels at least the pain of being defeated. And what to speak of somebody who attacks you and kills you when you're not even watching. You know, Krishna was sitting in a meditative posture, just sitting under a tree with his legs stretched out, not exactly meditative posture, but he was meditating, he was absorbed in his thought, and suddenly somebody attacks. It's actually a very cowardly, very unfair, very outrageous kind of attack. And yet Krishna was not in the least angry about it. Krishna told me, this is all a part of my plan. And further, Krishna had already told Arjuna, Krishna actually sent a message through Uddhava to Arjuna that now I am going to depart from this world, associates are going to depart. So you take the remaining residents of Dwarka to safety. And so basically Krishna knew everything that was happening. Shukadeva Goswami also further says that if you look at Krishna Leela, prior to that, Krishna had gone even to the abode of Yamaraj. Normally when somebody goes to the abode of Yamaraj, the person doesn't come back. So you die, you don't come back. Not only did Krishna come back, but Krishna brought back people who had gone there. Now we have the case of Krishna's spiritual master, Sandipani Muni. His sons died and Krishna went and brought back that son. So the point is, if we want to look at Krishna's death or if we want to look at Krishna's life, Krishna's departure, Krishna's life, there is nothing ordinary about it. And that's why ordinary logic cannot apply over there. Then why did Krishna leave the body over there when he departed? So, in Jiva Goswami explains in his Shatsandarbhas, and Krishna Goswami also talks about this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He says that some of the leelas of the Lord are Asura Mohan Leela. Asura Mohan Leela means, normally the leela is performed to attract the devotees. But some leela Krishna performs to delude the demons. The demons, who Krishna's mercifulness is there such that Krishna can actually attract everyone, Krishna can attract even the demons. But there are some people who are so stubbornly demoniac that they don't want to change at all. So then Krishna allows them to stay in illusion. Krishna allows them to stay in illusion. There's a classic example of this in the Mahabharata. On the 14th day, when Arjuna set out to kill Jayadratha, so at that time, the Kauravas arranged their whole army to stop Arjuna. And yet, Arjuna is breaking through their formation and destroying everyone. And to assist Arjuna, Yudhishthira first sent to assist him behind him, he sent Satyaki, and after that he sent Bhima. And on that one day, Bhima was so angry, Bhima penetrated into the Kaurava ranks, and on one day, Bhima killed 30 of Duryodhana's brothers. And when Duryodhana heard this, shocked. And he says, really? So these Pandavas are charmed. My whole army is not able to stop them. And despite everyone being a Drona, Karna, Shalya, all of them, no one is able to, Ashwatthama, nobody is able to stop Arjuna. Bhima has killed 60 of my brothers. Surely, he said, Bhishma told me that I cannot win against the Pandavas because Krishna is on their side. Krishna must be God. This Lord Krishna must be God. What is the use of fighting against God? I was thinking like this. He saw the sun going close to the horizon. Oh, there is a time still, the sun has not set. He started thinking. His desire to defy Krishna, his desire to defy the Pandava, to defeat the Pandava, so strong. And there was such overwhelming evidence of Krishna's power that he just disregarded all. And he thought, if Krishna is God, how could we have killed Abhimanyu yesterday? Now, Abhimanyu was dear to Arjuna and Arjuna is dear to Krishna. The very fact that we killed Abhimanyu yesterday means that Krishna is not God. And because Krishna is not God, we will be able to fight and stop Arjuna. And immediately he summoned 6 different warriors come between Arjuna and Jayadratha to protect Jayadratha. So the point is, it is said that for a believer needs no reasons and a non-believer accepts no reasons. So that's how it works out, that for some people who want to disbelieve in Krishna's divinity, Krishna provides them reasons. And one such reason Krishna provided when he left his body behind. And he arranged that even, according to some parts of the tradition, that even the body was cremated. But all this was Krishna had his own transcendental form. That transcendental form went back to the spiritual world. But for the sake of deluding the demons, he left behind a body. And by that, the demons could say that, oh, Krishna is not God. And that's how they could continue in their demoniac mentality.
Can I ask one question? I am by birth a Jain, and I understand the Jains say that Krishna is still living in hell. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Can you just elaborate on that?
So, according to Jains, Jain conception, Krishna is still living in hell. Is this true? Actually, you see, Jainism and Buddhism, these two religions emerged in India as a result of the exploitative caste Brahmanas who were monopolizing all power and privilege and neglecting the lower castes. There are many reasons, but this was the main reason. And that the Jainism and Buddhism, they attracted a lot of people, especially from the lower castes. And later on, they spread also very rapidly. Now, because the Vedic culture at that time was so prominent, so Jainism and Buddhism, they wanted to be ideologically autonomous. But still, most of the people who became Jains and Buddhists, they were coming from a culture that was very deeply steeped in Vedic imagery. And that is why originally these religions were meant to serve a particular purpose of, you know, elevating people to basic good living, moral living. And in general, if you see, Buddha himself did not talk much about ideology, and Mahavira and the other Tirthankaras also, they did not talk about much philosophy. Their focus was primarily on living in the mode of goodness, live properly. And the subsequent thinkers within those traditions, they came up with various ideological interpretations of the teachings of their founders. So what they tried to do is, in these religions, because they wanted ideological autonomy and the followers were still steeped in the imagery coming from the Vedic culture, they often retold in a fictional way the stories which were known to those followers. So for example, there's a Jain Ramayana. And the Jain Ramayana, now what happens is, this basic storyline is more or less similar. But throughout his forest stay, Ram keeps meeting Jain sages. And he gets good advice from the Jain sages. And at the end, when Sita is taken by the earth, at that time, Ram becomes enlightened and becomes a Jain. So this is basically a fictionalized retelling of the Ramayana, which was done by later Jain thinkers to try to subordinate a person who was very popular within the people at that time to say that he was also a Jain. So this is actually, Christians also did this. This is, for example, what Christians did is, when Christianity came from the Middle East to Europe, to Greek. Now Greece was a place of learning. And there the Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, these were big philosophers. As compared to that, the Christian theology, the teachings of the New Testament were very simplistic. So St. Augustine and others, they integrated the two. Say Greek philosophy with a biblical theology. But then how could they take Greek theology? Because Jesus has not taught that. So St. Augustine and other Christian teachers, they posthumously appropriated Socrates, Plato and Aristotle as pre-Christ Christians. They were not Christians actually, but they appropriated him like that. So in general, when a religion wants to spread, quite often they try to appropriate the pre-existing imagery that is there into their own storyline. So like that, in the Jain spin that was given to the Mahabharata, the idea is that some of the activities that Krishna did in the Mahabharata, they, from a moral perspective, appear to be wrong. Now, in an earlier class, I discussed about how morality is not just contextual. Morality is not categorical, it is contextual. What is right and what is wrong will vary according to time, place, circumstance. And Krishna did not act immorally. what Krishna acted was actually according to higher principle of dharma only in those situations. But because Krishna acted immorally, so some later people in the Jain tradition, they spun the Ramayana around and they said that because he acted immorally, so he has to go to hell. But this is a completely fictionalized rendition of the Mahabharata. And actually, Krishna is the Supreme Lord and he eternally resides in the spiritual world. And periodically, he descends to the world in various forms to elevate people. Okay. What is the difference between a Brahmin and a sage? Both can be similar. A sage is basically a person who has spiritual wisdom and spiritual vision. A Brahmin is a person who belongs to a particular varna of a Brahmana. Now, ideally speaking, a Brahmana should also have a spiritual vision. Brahma janati iti Brahmana. So, if a Brahmin is truly a Brahmin in quality, then that Brahmin will naturally be a sage. But if somebody is a Brahmin just by birth and not in quality, then there may be that person may be a Brahmana but may not be a sage. Okay. If the mind, body and intelligence do sinful activities, then why does the soul suffer for those sinful activities? Answer, the mind, intelligence and body, they don't do it. It is, they propose it. It is the soul who accepts it. The example to understand this is, suppose somebody is surfing the net and is surfing on some site where you are shopping something and suddenly some pop-up window comes up and that's also a nasty site. Now the computer doesn't take us to that site itself. The computer prompts us. It is we who click and then we go there. So like that, our mind, our senses, they pop-up images in our consciousness. But when those images pop up, when those ideas pop up, when those desires pop up, it is we who accept them. It is we who act on them. That's why the doer is the soul. The doer is not the body, the mind or the intelligence. They can be the proposers. We are the doers. To give another example to illustrate this, let's say a person is driving a car and next to them there's a child. And the child is instructing, see that. And the child is directing everywhere. Now this person who is driving, that person has the steering wheels. And the child cannot push this person away and take the steering wheel and take the car in some other direction. But the child can distract. And the child distracts, go there. Now if this person listens to that child, and they will go in that direction. If they don't listen to that child, they will not go in that direction. So that mind, our mind is like the distracting child. We as the soul are like the person at the wheels of the car. So it is we who choose. So it is because what do we choose? We may not choose the occurrence of the desire. The desire may come on its own. But the indulgence of the desire is what we choose. And we are responsible for that choice. So, how does the ego play a role in this? The ego is what causes us to misidentify with the voices of the mind, intelligence. The intelligence here, by intelligence, we refer to the materialistic intelligence or the senses. Krishna talks in the Bhagavad Gita in 3.40 that Indriyani Manobuddhir Asya Adhishthanam Uchyate. That selfish desire is present in the senses, the mind, and the intelligence. So, basically, it is because we choose to do the action, that's why we get the consequences. How can we connect with Krishna or think of Krishna when we work in a factory or office for 8 hours a day? Yes. Primarily, it depends on how we connect with Krishna when he's directly in front of us. When we have opportunity to come to temple, when we get to associate with devotees, when we have opportunity to chant the holy names, at that time how much we connect with Krishna, that is more important. Now suppose, say a husband is working in some different city and the husband comes back home and then he tells his wife, when I am there, I think of you constantly. But then the wife starts talking with him, the husband starts checking his messages, SMS. And the wife will say, See, when I am right in front of you, you are not even thinking of me then. How can I believe you are thinking of me when I am not in front of you? Isn't it? So similarly, you know, when Krishna is right in front of us, when Krishna is manifesting as the holy name, when Krishna is manifesting as scripture, and Krishna is manifesting as the deities, at that time we focus on trying to offer our consciousness as much as possible to Krishna. These are the times when we solidify our connection with Krishna. And if we do this solidly, gradually Krishna will enter into our consciousness as the goal of our life. See, Vishwanath Chakravarti gives the example of how we can think of Krishna constantly. He says, suppose a man is working. A person may be far away from home and it may be doing various kinds of job, maybe meeting with this person, negotiating here, dealing there, traveling there. But through it all, the man is thinking that I am doing this for my wife, I am doing this for my children. I want to take care of them, I want to maintain them. So it may not be, the thoughts of the family may not be constantly in the foreground, but they are there in the background as the purpose of why one is doing that thing. So similarly, he says, as we keep practicing bhakti, as we understand the philosophy, Krishna becomes the goal of our life. And when Krishna becomes the goal of our life, then whatever we do, we may be in a job, we may be in an office, we may be doing a job. Now initially we may do a job because we just think, yes, I want to earn a lot of money. I want to become wealthy and famous and popular. But as we start practicing bhakti, more and more Krishna becomes the goal of our life. Then we say, I am doing this job so that I can get Lakshmi, I can use Lakshmi in Krishna's service. So the activity may remain the same, but the motivation, the inspiration changes. And that's why when to the extent we are associating with Krishna nicely, when Krishna is directly manifest before us, to that extent our attraction to Krishna increases. To that extent, we become inspired by the desire to serve Krishna. And when that desire to serve Krishna becomes the primary driving motivation in our life, then that desire to serve underlies all our other activities also. Whether it may be in a family or maybe in office, that motive will be to serve Krishna. And that will define, and that will be the background presence, even if it is not the foreground presence. And additionally, even when we are working, we can try to create spiritual stimuli. And if you are working on a computer, we can have some Krishna-related wallpapers. If you are doing work that is not intellectually demanding, we can hear some soft spiritual music, some kirtans. If we strive to serve Krishna, and if we strive to remember Krishna, Krishna will give us intelligence about how we can remember Him. Krishna will give us ideas. So many devotees during their lunch break, they may hear some philosophy. If we find within our professional circles, there is someone else who is spiritually minded. Then we try to share Krishna consciousness with them. And that way also we can spiritualize our workplace. But principally, it is not that to remember Krishna is not possible when we are working. We shouldn't think of remembering Krishna as a simplistic, artificial stuffing of our mind with Krishna. Remembering Krishna is something that organically emerges when there is attachment to Krishna. So, we focus on the direct devotional activities by which we become attached to Krishna. And when that attachment to Krishna comes, then organically, He will animate our whole life as our driving purpose. So I am a university student and I have just joined ISKCON. Please tell me how I can be a devotee in my position and age group, and what should I do to be a good devotee and serve the Lord? Yes, it's fortunate that in youth itself, you had opportunity to connect with Krishna. And youth is a time when we have energy, we have intellectual sharpness, and we have a lot of drive in our lives. And if at that this time, we can get Krishna into our life, then all our youthful energy, intelligence, drive, that can all be constructively utilized. So one of the biggest temptations in youth is that often we want to postpone a spiritual life to later. But that idea of postponing spiritual life to later, that comes on because we think that spiritual life has only otherworldly benefits. Yes, in my old age I'll practice bhakti, then I'll go back to Krishna. But spiritual life also offers this worldly benefits. And when you practice spiritual life seriously, it enables us to actually become more focused, more calm, more self-controlled, by which whatever we are doing, we'll be able to do it better. So the vision of life that bhakti offers us is that what we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift to God. What we are, whatever talents we have, whatever abilities we have, whatever resources we have, they are our God's gift to us. And we use them. Use them in a mood of service. We develop those abilities. We become better. And that is our gift to God. So the studies that we are doing, whatever university position we are in, you see that these studies, I'm not just doing this to get a job or to get a degree. I'm doing these studies to serve Krishna. And earlier we may study just to get good marks, but we can study now. If we study nicely, we get good marks, our friends ask us, you know, what is it that enables you to study? How do you do so well? Then we can tell them, yes, I study, but I also am devoted to Krishna. That helps me to focus. That helps me to do well. We should see our service, our studies also, as a means to serve Krishna. And that way, if we focus primarily on direct devotional activities, as much as our schedules allow, then we can move onwards towards Krishna even through our other activities, including our study. So if possible, try to find other devotees in the same age group. And with those devotees in the other age group, in a similar age group, you will also have like-minded association. And that way you can move forward towards Krishna. How important are Shastric injunctions for all devotees to follow and why? Shastra is basically like a manual. So how important is the manual? Manual is what enables us to operate a machine properly. So like that, life we can live best when we live according to Shastra. See, broadly speaking, we make our decisions based on four factors. First is fashion. Now, why do I wear this dress? Because everyone is wearing it. Everyone is doing it, so I do it. Second is tradition. Okay, why do I do like this? Because we have already done it like this. Third is feeling. Hey, why did you go over there? I felt like going there. Fourth is logic. Why do that? It made sense to me. Now, all these four are useful. They can be potentially useful guides in our life. But fashions can be foolish quite often, you know. Oscar Wilde said fashion is a form of ugliness so intolerable that we have to change it every 6 months. So the corporate controlled media, it's determined that one thing is fashionable and we rush to purchase it. And after some time, that same media determines something else will be fashionable and that becomes old fashioned. So we have to give it up after that. So fashions can make us foolish sometimes. Traditions, not all traditions are right. Many traditions can be wrong also. Many much that come, for example, within the Vedic tradition itself, it's the idea that a person is Brahmana by birth. That's something which is wrong. So tradition can also mislead us. And our feelings are notoriously fickle. The same thing I like today, tomorrow I just can't tolerate it. No. When we are driven just by feelings, now when two people form a relationship simply by based on feelings, they may say initially, I can't live without you. And then after 6 months, I can't live with you. So, if you are driven only by feelings, we cannot move on. And logic is useful. Logic is valuable. But our logic is also limited. We may not have enough information. We may not have enough intellectual capacity to reason things properly. So, all these four are useful parameters. But they are not adequate sufficient parameters. Beyond all these, we need scripture. Scripture is the word of God. That is the manual. And we subordinate and integrate fashion, tradition, feeling and logic with scripture. And when we follow scripture, that is the lighthouse that guides us. That is the lighthouse which will never mislead us. As I said, through Shastra, Shastra has a lot of knowledge. But the most important part of Shastra is, it guides us about how we should act in our life. Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te Karya Karya Vastita Ujyatva Shastridhana Uktam Karma Kartam Iharasi. Krishna says that, therefore, act according to Shastra and in this way you will attain auspiciousness in life. What are the essential qualities of leaders and how leaders can motivate others in Krishna consciousness? What is the difference between a boss and a leader? Okay, see, as far as inspiring or influencing others is concerned, everybody has free will, and the door to individual transformation can be opened only from inside. The door to individual transformation, it cannot be opened from outside. It can be opened only from inside. As they say that we can take a person, we can take a horse to the water, we cannot force the horse to drink. So we cannot force anyone to do anything. Krishna at the end of the Bhagavad Gita also says that yathechasi tatha kuru, that as you desire, so you do. Deliberate, vimrishayatashayashena, yathechasi tatha kuru. Deliberate deeply and then you decide what you want to do. So the first principle in leadership is to recognize that others are independent living beings. We cannot force anyone to do something. To the extent we think that others should obey me, to that extent we will set ourselves up for frustration. Now this does not mean that we shouldn't guide or we shouldn't lead, but we always need to know that they are independent people. And I cannot just throw a tantrum if others don't obey me. They are free, they can do whatever they want. And it is, that's why we cannot demand obedience, we have to, as I say, command respect. We cannot demand respect. Now, how can we influence others then? We can't force anyone to do anything, but we can inspire them. The way in general one human being can guide or influence or shape others' actions is basically three categories. Provide knowledge, offer facility, set example. Whether it is a leader in a community, whether it is a parent for children, whether it is a counselor for a counselee, these are the three main things we can do for others. First is provide knowledge. No, we tell this is right, this is wrong. This is, and not just this is right, this is wrong. Not just do this, don't do this. We explain why it is right, why it is wrong. Why this is beneficial, why this is wrong. So not just giving a set of fiats. Do this, don't do this. You know, that sort of leadership doesn't work at all. There's a atheist gag on the Bible. Gag means like a cheap joke. They say, in the beginning was the word, and the word was no. In the beginning was the word, and the first sentence of the Bible is, in the beginning was the word, and the word was God. And I say, the word was no. People have this very negative conception of religion. Religion means, no, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. It's not like that. So as leaders, we shouldn't just cue, don't do this, don't do this. We actually provide systematic knowledge of why something should be done, why should not be done. Second is, create facilities. If you just tell people that, okay, suppose somebody says, you know, you should not take anything except prasad. But then there is no prasad available anywhere. Are people to starve then? No. If we say all of you should fast for Ekadashi and the only food available is grains, what will people do? If we tell people to do something, it is our responsibility to provide facilities for them to do that thing. Now create facilities. So parents, if they want their children to become devotees, now they have to create a forum where there are other children of the same age group, where children can play with other children who are devotees. Basically create facilities for them to learn and relish Krishna consciousness in the way that is suitable for them. So just giving knowledge without creating facilities is inadequate. And third is, set example. So Krishna consciousness is more caught than taught. I may say, do this, don't do like this. But if I say that, you know, we should very prayerfully offer our respects and worship the deity. But when the deity darshan happens, I am looking everywhere except at the deities. Then people will catch that much more than what I spoke in the class. So it's very important that we set example. So set example means that whatever principles of Krishna consciousness we are talking about, we also try according to our capacity to exemplify that. And actually if you see, this is what Srila Prabhupada did. You know, he provided knowledge. He wrote books, he gave classes. And he created the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which is basically a facility. And if we hear about Srila Prabhupada's life, he said, such an example. Constantly, wherever he would go, he was remembering Krishna. So leadership essentially means providing knowledge, creating facilities, and setting an example. If we do this, now creating facilities also means, if we tell people to serve Krishna, we need to create systematic facilities by which people can serve Krishna. So provide them services, provide them facilities to execute those services. And if we do this, then definitely we can inspire many, many people to move closer towards Krishna. So I feel very inspired to become a strong devotee and devote myself to Krishna. But I also have a very short temper and I can't control my material desires. What should I do? So once Srila Prabhupada was asked, if our desire is to serve Krishna, if our purpose is to serve Krishna, why is Maya so strong? So Prabhupada replied, because your purpose is not strong. Because your purpose is not strong. What this means is that we are innately pleasure-seeking creatures and we cannot live without pleasure. But we can choose where to seek pleasure. So quite often if our conviction is not strong, conviction means when you say, okay, spiritual advancement, in loving Krishna there is real happiness. If conviction is not strong, then our determination cannot be strong. See, conviction is conviction refers to our internal understanding. Determination refers to our external action. So we cannot have determination without conviction. Trying to have determination without conviction is like trying to build a big building in a marsh. The building is just going to sink, it's going to collapse. So quite often when you say that, I don't have determination, the problem is I don't have conviction. So if you study the philosophy more carefully, understand the philosophical concepts, then our conviction will deepen. When the conviction deepens, then automatically the determination will also become strong. So as far as the principles of bhakti are concerned, irrespective of whether we have material desires or not, irrespective of that, whatever we are doing, we should always keep practicing bhakti. That means no matter what all problems we have, we should always keep practicing bhakti. And by practicing bhakti, the anarthas will get removed. So find out ways in which we can serve Krishna in a way that purifies us, that connects us with Krishna more and more. And as far as the short temper or as far as the material desires are concerned, we need not focus too much on them. Focus on Krishna. It's just like, say there's a glass here, and the glass, I decided I want to remove the air from the glass and make vacuum over there. It's very difficult. Even if after a lot of labor I create a vacuum over there, just a little bit, I shift the lid, immediately air will go inside. On the other hand, if I decide that I will fill the glass with water, fill the glass with water, automatically the air will go out. So like that, if I think, no, I will not become angry. I'll become angry and I will become angry about my not becoming angry. So that's why we needn't focus on the negative, we focus on the positive. We don't have to try to empty our mind of wrong desires. We should crowd wrong desires out of our mind. Crowd wrong desires means fill the mind with positive desires. Okay, let me try to do this for Krishna. And focus on that, and while trying to do that, the negative things will automatically go out in due course. So what is the importance of Ekadashi and the benefit of visiting temple on Ekadashi? Yes, Ekadashi is an opportunity for us to do intensely, at least for one day, what we are meant to do normally. That means the idea is that for us as sadhakas, to practice intense bhakti constantly is not very easy. So what we can do is at least for one day we practice intense bhakti. And by that intense practice of bhakti, we get a taste of Krishna consciousness. And that as that taste increases more and more, we come closer and closer to Krishna. So although in Ekadashi we may fast, but fasting is not the primary purpose of Ekadashi. Sometimes we may fast. And we may fast and then we may go and see who is eating what. This person eats so much. Ekadashi and you're eating sweets. He is eating this, eating that. Now if we are doing like that, then our body may be fasting, but our ego is feasting. So, the purpose of fasting is not to just not just to show how sense controlled we are to the world. The purpose of fasting is to increase our meditation on Krishna, to put aside bodily distractions so that we can increase our focus on Krishna. And it is said that whatever bhakti that we do on Ekadashi, Ekadashi is a special day for Lord Vishnu. And I said whatever bhakti we do on Ekadashi, on that day we get special mercy. We get much, much more devotional credits for whatever we do on Ekadashi. And that's why any devotional activity that we do on Ekadashi, such as coming to a temple, that is very beneficial. So if we can't come to a temple regularly, at least we can come on Ekadashi. And the important thing is, we try to increase our remembrance of Krishna. And the more we remember Krishna, more we try to connect with Krishna, especially on the sacred day Ekadashi, the more we can come closer and closer to Krishna by that. What values can senior devotees impart to devotees in general? How should they help? How should they conduct their life so that they can help others? Yes, in any course of action that we follow, you know, when a student say joins an engineering degree or say joins engineering college, the one thing that they see is, okay, those who passed out from their college, what are they doing? If they are in good positions, if they have a bright career, the students will say, yes, let me go there. But if they see that, oh, this person is done engineering and now they are unemployed, living on dole, should I do engineering? They will start getting second thoughts. So, whenever we practice, when we take up any process, we look at those who have followed this process, what have they done? Where are they situated? So, bhakti is a process of inner transformation. That inner transformation which makes us devoted to Krishna. And Prabhupada was asked, how do you know, how can we know your disciples? And Prabhupada could have given many answers. They are always chanting Hare Krishna. He says, they wear tilak. No, Prabhupada says, my disciples are perfect gentlemen, perfect ladies and gentlemen. And Prabhupada focused on behavior. Behavior, you know, gentle, proper behavior, sattvic behavior. Internally we are remembering Krishna. But that internally the remembrance of Krishna should manifest as pleasing behavior. So if a senior devotee is, you know, we should be as kind and as gentle, as welcoming to new devotees. That is how that kindness, gentleness, sensitivity, that is what attracts people towards Krishna. And actually this is required not just for new people. This is required even among devotees. Sometimes it is said that now, when we come new to ISKCON, people feed us fried pakodas. And then after we become devotees, they fry us like pakodas. We sometimes take devotees for granted. Hey, they are already devotees. No, at every time, whether they have been practicing devotion, bhakti for 1 year or 5 years or 10 years, no, everyone has to get inspiration in bhakti. And we are not going to get inspiration in bhakti from non-devotees. We are going to get, the inspiration for bhakti has to come from devotees only. That's why the most important thing that senior devotees, they deal nicely with new people, that is very good. But how senior devotees deal with other devotees is important. Because when there is, ultimately people come for various reasons to spiritual organizations. The philosophy is only one of the reasons. It's an important reason, but it's only one of the reasons. One of the main reasons why people come is, people want a sense of community. People want a sense of belonging. And that's why if they see that, the people are so affectionate, people are so kind. Prabhupada writes in the Act of Instruction purport that the Krishna consciousness movement will grow, is nourished, and it will grow by the sixfold loving exchanges between devotees. So it's interesting, sixfold loving exchanges are giving gifts, receiving gifts, offering prasad, taking prasad, revealing one's heart, hearing others reveal one's heart. Actually, preaching is not there in any of these activities. We think Krishna conscious movement will go by preaching. Yes, we give classes to new people and attract them. Yes, it will grow by that. But after people are praying, they will see how we are living. So the sixfold loving exchanges need to be there among devotees. So senior devotees, if they exemplify this loving exchanges, then that will definitely attract a lot of, and inspire younger devotees and attract new people also. So that value of proper behavior, of sattvic behavior, loving Vaishnava behavior, that is what can inspire a lot of people to come towards Krishna. So how can a community avoid guru groupism? Okay. Actually, just now before I came here, I was just with His Grace Gurujan Prabhu, and he was telling me, we were discussing various things. So he said that, you may say that I am a Radhanath Swami disciple, and you may say that I am a disciple of Radhanath Swami. Is there a difference between the two? So I thought about it. I said, I am a Radhanath Swami disciple. When I say, that means Radhanath Swami disciple is one group, and I belong to that group. So the identification is primarily with the group. As when I say I am a disciple of Radhanath Swami, that means the focus is on the discipleship. That I am a disciple of a spiritual master. So quite often when we come to a spiritual organization also, we bring our material ego with us. So for example, in India there is nationalism. So the idea is Mera Bharat Mahan. Many Indians say that. But they don't know anything about India's spiritual world. They ask, they don't even know one verse from Bhagavad Gita. And why is Mera Bharat Mahan? Why is India great? Because I was born in India. So for me, the greatness of India is simply an extension of my false ego. So like that, unfortunately, when we come to spiritual organizations, we bring that ego into the spiritual circles also. So we think, yes, I am great, and therefore my guru must be the greatest. And therefore, we try to promote our spiritual master a lot. But Prabhupada, in a very beautiful lecture which he gave on the Vyaspuja offering of his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur said, he said, the guru is one, although he may manifest in many forms. So ultimately, Krishna Vande Jagat Guru. It is Krishna who is manifesting to guide us through various spiritual masters. And Krishna is unlimitedly attractive. And Krishna manifests his attractiveness through different spiritual masters. That means, Krishna, to one soul, Krishna may manifest his attractiveness through one spiritual master. To another soul, Krishna may manifest that same attractiveness through another spiritual master. But it is Krishna who is attracting them. It is Krishna who is attracting people. And when we say share Krishna consciousness with others, and we attract people towards Krishna. So if we have this mentality of the extended false ego, then we think that, oh, my group should become bigger. And so people who come to my group, they should become, new people come, they should come to my group. But if we think that actually this soul is a part of Krishna, and my duty is to help this soul to become attracted to Krishna. So, whichever medium through which Krishna manifests his attractiveness and attracts the soul, that is fine, because that person is essentially meant to be attracted towards Krishna. And when we have this understanding, spiritual understanding of the dynamics of what is happening, it is not we who are bringing somebody to become a devotee. You know, we may think, oh, I preach to you, so therefore you should take initiation from my spiritual master. First of all, to think that I preach to you, I made you into a devotee, that itself is an illusion. Now, Prabhupada is Mahabhagavat. And when Prabhupada is composing the Markine Bhagavata Dharma, and Markine Bhagavata Dharma is the song that Prabhupada composed when he was in Jaladuta. And there, what is he praying? He is not saying that, oh, I am going to make all these Americans into devotees. Prabhupada is saying, Krishna, by your mercy, please make my words understandable to them. And then he says, Tomara ichchai sabha hoy mayavash, Tomara ichchai nasha mayara parash. He says, it is by your will that all people have come under illusion. It is by your will that people can come out of illusion. If you desire, O Lord, that people come out of illusion, then please make my words understandable to them. So Prabhupada is himself not thinking that I am making someone into a devotee. He's simply saying that Krishna, by his will remove illusion and inspire people to become devoted to him. Let me just be an instrument. So if we have that mood of being an instrument, then we can avoid this sort of guru-groupism. Now, there's another point here, that there is a natural identification. Yes, if I am initiated by a particular spiritual master, then others who are initiated by the spiritual master, there's a natural affinity between them. But this sort of affection cannot be legislated. It cannot be legislated. Sometimes, some of my closest friends are devotees who are disciples of other spiritual masters. Relationships cannot be mandated. So if we focus too much on externals, then we forget the principle of bhakti. The principle of bhakti is, we want to develop relationship with Krishna, we want to help others develop relationship with Krishna, and we want to develop relationships with those who have relationship with Krishna. So if others are also disciples of the same spiritual master, that may and that can act as an impetus for us to develop relationship with them. But it is not necessary that our relationship will only be with them. So we need to keep our spiritual focus in mind. Our spiritual focus is that we want to love Krishna, and we want to inspire others to love Krishna. And whatever is favorable for that, we need to do that. By keeping the spiritual focus in mind, we can avoid extending the false ego into the spiritual realm in the name of things like Guru Groupism. So I think it's already 9:15. So actually, I have my website, thespiritualscientist.com. So after I can take all these questions and I can answer these questions there. If any of your questions are not answered, if you subscribe for the daily feed on Spiritual Scientist, in your inbox you will get the answers. And many of the questions which I answered here, some of them have also been answered over there. So if your questions are not answered, you can either search on the Spiritual Scientist or you can subscribe for the feed. You can get the answers over there later. Okay. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki. Hare Krishna.